Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to Bugle 4059, sub-episode A. We are having a week off this week in an effort to stop all global news from happening. And because I'm on tour, and it's half-term, and the heat death of the universe is only 5 billion years away, so what's the point? Instead, we have a sub-episode for you containing some classic Bugle Valentine's Day facts from the Bugle Fact Archives, the primary repository of historical veracity in the known world, plus some choice snippets from my recent Satirist for Hire shows in Dublin on the 11th of February, and way back in the icy bleakness of January, Aldershot.
Well, Jose, we'll start with you, because since you're one of the two people to actually send in advance, a number of topics you sent. For the second time in a row, I've been out of the UK for a few days before your show at the Westie. All right, Columbus, don't flash it about, mate. All travelled. I would like you to satirise this. Hotel breakfasts. that was the idea when I started this show, was so people could have, the big political issues of the world that are really affecting them deeply satirised. How long have you been away? Three nights. Was this work or holiday? Holiday. Oh, holiday, right. And hotel, would they upset you, the hotel breakfast?
They're just so bonkers in their
variety. Oh, right. And you want, what, just a single standardised global breakfast? Is there not enough uncertainty in this world? Why must we have the division over whether we should have bacon and eggs or pancakes or whatever the Belgians eat? Swiss with their f***ing muesli? What the f*** is muesli? It's gravel with dust. The concept of delayed guilt. Sorry? People, yes, well, this is it. This is the buffet breakfast, is a living metaphor for the pitfalls of unbridled capitalism. So every time you go to a buffet breakfast, you are living out the dangers of a lack of regulation of the global financial market. So remember that. Because I've tried this myself. I have no buffet discipline. And, the number of times I've been sitting there, looking at my fifth sausage and the three uneaten slices of black pudding on my plate, and I think, no, we really need to do something more to control the unregulated banking sector. Humans have no self-discipline at all, and we've seen this. I mean, I think fundamentally the way we've left the financial markets as unregulated as a breakfast buffet, that is like it was as short-sighted as a man getting a new Labrador and training that Labrador to eat nothing but sausages and Scotch eggs, and then taking that Labrador with him on a nudist holiday. It was, at some point, quite obviously going to come back to bite us, literally. family show. You worry about the health implications of this sort of unbridled breakfast consumerism. It is bacon and pickled fish. It was Iceland. In Iceland. Yeah, because the Scandinavians, they go for pickled fish, which I don't think is enough. But by way of apology for what the Vikings did on these shores, it's not enough. It's too little, too late. Other non-travel thoughts, Jose, you asked for, social media bosses not using social media. I guess it's the old saying, don't shit in your own lunchbox. It's not just social. I mean, do you think Ronald McDonald actually eats the shit in his own restaurants? No, he has his own private chef, Ronald McDonald. Custard pies, mostly. occasionally quiche with cheese and egg on top. Maybe a deep pan pizza with mozzarella and celeriac foam. Basically anything that can be smashed in the face for comedic effect. Leopards never change their spots, and clowns never change their trousers. That is a horrific fact of life in the circus. People don't always live up to what they claim to represent. Popes, for example, not all popes have fully lived out the teachings of Jesus Christ. And in particular, going way back in history, I'm not going to beat a drum against the Catholics here. I am lapsed Jewish, as I said, as are indeed all Catholics, in a way. I think that's why I'm so tolerant as a guy, because I view all Christians and Muslims as lapsed Jews like me. So, I think there might be something in that. Someone write that down. But the popes, some amazing. If you're compiling your worst ever popes list, some of them have done some incredible things. Pope John the 12th, really leading the way. But Alexander the 6th, he had competitive fornicating competitions, which were on Sky Sports Vatican at the time. Boniface the 8th once slaughtered an entire town of 6,000 people, which is not the most popey behaviour you've ever seen, is it? Benedict the 9th, he sold off the papacy. Philip Hammond's kind of pope, I guess. Also renowned as the 11th century's gayest pope, which was a surprisingly hotly contested title. Also more of a fan of the massive orgy than some of the more sexually demure popes we've had in recent times. And Pope Rabbi Yitzchel Schnack Skibitzkibitz. Very bad pope. He was appointed in 1979 due to a clerical error and stepped down immediately after walking into the Vatican on his first day and appearing on the balcony of St. Peter's with an inflatable Moses, shouting, "So you losers have finally come to your senses after 2,000 years. But John the 12th, I mean, worst ever pope. You talk about social media leaders being hypocrites. John the 12th ordained a deacon in a stable. I guess he's not that far away from giving birth in a manger, is it? I mean, Donald Trump before Christmas, he said, the nativity story shows you know what is important in life. You know, the value of family and love. And he said, no, Donald, the lesson from the nativity story is what happens if you cripplingly underfund public healthcare. Yeah. People give birth in a fucking farm. There's a good joke in there somewhere, but it didn't come out tonight. John the 12th, he slept with his sisters. He stole money and possessions from the church. He drank toasts to the devil. He castrated a cardinal. He used to invoke pagan gods whilst playing dice. He was quite keen as a hobby on maiming and mutilating his opponents, or if you will, his pope-ponents. And he ended up being beaten to death with a hammer by a jealous husband whose wife, Pope John, was in the process of pope-a-doping in a most unpopesome manner. And one assumes that as he was hammered to death by this, the last thought that went through his head was, yeah, I did kind of have this coming. I did kind of have this coming. Which I assume was going through Colonel Gaddafi's mind as well at the time. On aggregate, I reckon I'm still ahead. I'm just going to relax and try and make the best of it. He was made Pope at 16, interestingly, John the 12th. I guess if you're good enough, you're old enough. But it is a risk, having a 16-year-old Pope. But it didn't really work out. And he got some real stinging criticism from some of the contemporary monk commentators. In fact, there's this one manuscript from a monk at the time, one of the most prominent monk pundits from the Pope of the Day program, Alan Shearerius. This said at the end of Pope John the 12th's reign, he'll be disappointed with that. When you're Pope, you've simply got to do better. So, an interval shortly. I'll just run through a couple of the ones that were emailed in shortly before the start of the show. Susie Vermilio. Hello, Susie. Thanks for this. Have I pronounced your name right?
Yeah,
I
think so. I'm not married into it, but
I don't know. Are you married into it, so it's not your business? Correct? I mean, I don't really have fixed views on whether in the 21st century women should take their husbands' names or vice versa. But I think if you are going to do it, at least learn how to pronounce four syllables. It's a kind of dangerous middle ground you're in there. Please satirise the fact that Trump's statement that he hopes, quote, all sharks die, has led to a flood of donations in his name to conservation charities. This is just wonderful with a smiling emoji. Is that an emoji? Or an emojis? Is it emojis singular? I don't know. So I'm a bit out of the loop. I think this is, again, everything with Trump is twisted against him. He said he hopes all sharks die. I mean, that's just realism, isn't it? That is a Christian man hoping that we do not discover an immortal shark who turns out to be the real Messiah. So he hopes, because he wants to cling to the idea of a human Messiah. But, I mean, no one wants a shark saviour. I mean, what kind of standards of behaviour would that set? you know, just an animal that consumes everything in its path with no regard for the welfare. Actually, that's Trump's ideal messiah. Right, Neil. There's you. Hello, Neil. The second of the two emails sent in before 7:30 today. Glad you're coming back to the Westie, the best art centre in the world. Yay! In the world. Yes. I've checked. It's not. Sorry. How is it judged anyway? Because you said, because I just checked the official rankings. It's not top. Top is the Montevideo Teatralia des Artes e Comunitado Centrada in Uruguay. Followed by the entire city of Dubai, which is a living arts installation of the folly of humanity. And the West End Centre is third. It's not bad. Not bad. Done very well. But in the world, you get the... Obviously... You get the absolute cream of comedy here. Clearly, that goes not like the O2, that overpriced piece of shit. I went to see something at the O2. Who's been to the O2 in London? Yeah. To see comedy? No. See, I went to see something there a couple of years ago. It was absolute shit. Not funny at all. It was a show called Roger Federer versus Rafael Nadal. And I'd heard these two guys were really great, but they just hit these little yellow balls at each other. I don't know if it was like meta comedy. It was like funny because it's not funny. Kind of. I blame The Office for that. And it's very repetitious as well. Same thing over now. That's Stuart Lee's fault, frankly. But a bit of slapstick when the ball went into the net every now and again. But overall, bullshit. And the support act sitting in the high chair, he was the best guy. At least he f***ing said something. Of course, that's nonsense. Federer and Nadal haven't played at the World Tour Finals in London since 2011. Anyway, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know that.
That was Aldershot. Well, I hope, Buglers, that you had a truly sensational Valentine's Day last week and fell in love with as many people as humanly possible. Now it's time for some Valentine's Day facts, as brought to you in the past by us.
So welcome to February. This is the first February broadcast of the 2009 calendar year. February, of course, John, the newest month of the 12 current first choice months being used at the moment. Roman King Numa Pompilius invented February and its close buddy January when he realised that the Romans were wasting the first 59 days of the year sitting around doing Sweet Jemima crankshaft waiting for March to begin. Now, of course, being the last month to be discovered, John, February had to make do with the very last few remaining scrap days left over after the other months had had their fill, plus 12 days given to it by September, which until then had clocked in at a big, fat, distended 42 days. For more than 1,000 years, February was roundly teased by all the other months until St. Valentine, the patron saint of hackneyed chat-up lines and clumsy passes, posted himself anonymously to a nun he fancied on the 10th of February one year. Arriving by second-class post 4 days later, a hungry, cold and urine-soaked Valentine tumbled out of his cardboard and bubble wrap package onto the nun's floor and recited these lines. Roses are red, violets are blue, I'm a rhino in bed and I'll bet you are too. Love from guess who? Before the nun smashed him over the head with a bronze Virgin Mary trophy she'd won the previous day as Miss Chaste, 453 AD. Valentine slumped to the floor, mumbled, I wouldn't mind breaking your habits. She clunked him again. He burbled, sister, sizzler more like. She booted him in the head with her size 9 Magdalen 3000 nun boots and he whispered, I love you so much I'm falling to bits. Now whip off your wimple and show me at which point she body slammed him while screaming, Hail Mary, full in your face. And Valentine died instantly but happily. Of course, the big saint was then commemorated by Valentine's Day, which, along with February's relaunch as the end of winter month, thrust it into the mainstream as a month where it has remained ever since. It's been month of the year on 14 occasions, most recently in 1935. There, a bit of background on February for you there.
Well, that was from the mind of Andy Zaltzman, father of two.
I'm 34. I'm 34, John, and to illustrate quite how suited I am to the responsibilities, the onerous responsibilities of fatherhood, a couple of weeks ago I bought a new shirt for our Comedians Tuesday football game, yeah. John. It's bright pink, and it's awarded to the person who does the worst miss of the day. And I also ordered some big letters to go on the back spelling out the word loser. I'm a 34-year-old father of two, an Oxford graduate. Where's it all gone wrong? Anyway, week beginning February the 2nd, February the 1st, John, 60 years since the end of wartime clothes rationing in Britain. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say, John, that neither you nor I have fully adjusted.
Know. You wouldn't know.
That's a pre-rationing levels yet. It's Valentine's Day on Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Valentine's Day on Sunday, the 14th of February. Yep. And it's been marked by a very controversial story here, John, that has yet again torn Britain apart at its very seams, in which a primary school in Somerset has banned pupils from sending Valentine's cards to each other to save them the, quote, emotional trauma of being rejected.
Oh, dear. So, I think it's a very bad move, Andy, because it is important that children at the earliest possible age have their hearts trampled to the ground and their souls crushed.
Yeah.
It's character building, Andy. Sets them up for the real world they're about to enter.
They need to learn how to deal with rejection, because rejection, John, to me, is the beef mince in the bolognese of life. Without it, it lacks depth and texture. And I think as a nation, we are bad at dealing with rejection. Ever since the Empire said, that's it, it's over, Britain, I've had enough. And Britain replied, I can change, just give me another chance. I promise I won't exploit you again, you f***ing ungrateful bitch.
I think the best Valentine's Day card I ever had, Andy, I think I was like around 9 years old. And there was a girl who gave me a card which wasn't so much affectionate as it just, it had a 10-point breakdown. Why do you not like me? And there was then 10-point argument, which is pretty advanced for a 9-year-old, to which my only response could be, I just don't see the point of you yet. I didn't even know yet at that point. I just thought, I just don't get the point.
Where is she now?
I don't know. I can't, actually can't even remember her name, Andy. Isn't that sad?
Right. Well, if you're listening...
I tell you, I did...
Do email us.
Yeah. I tell you what I would like to know, Andy. The first girl I ever loved...
Right.
Was, I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
Sarah Constable.
Oh, right.
And I loved her because she had blue glasses, I remember, and very shiny black sandal shoes.
Okay.
And I thought both of those things were very cool.
You shallow bastard.
I was ahead of my time in terms of how vapid I was. Now, personally, Andy, I'm not a big fan of Valentine's Day, but even I wouldn't take it as far as Saudi Arabia, who on Thursday launched a nationwide crackdown on stores selling items that are either red or heart-shaped or in any other way allude to Valentine's Day, which is banned there. They've officially banned it. Red-coloured or heart-shaped items are legal, apparently, other times of years, but as February 14th nears, they become completely contraband in Saudi Arabia. Boy, they, you know, they never cease to surprise with just how intolerant they are. Listen, I don't particularly like the day either, but easy.
I think this thing about rejection, learning to accept rejection is very important, John. And because, you know, I've learned to deal with rejection. I got rejected a number of times. I got rejected when I applied for a job to be a sub-editor for Potato Processing International magazine.
Uh-huh.
Back in 1997.
Yeah.
I wasn't even good enough for that. But it made me think how differently my life could have turned out if I'd got that job.
You'd have been great at it, Andy. You'd have been the best potato processing writer of all time. Yeah. I firmly believe that.
I just think by now, you know, I might have been able to move sideways and work on its sister publication, Potato Storage International, that was launched in 2004.
Clearly, please, these guys... Please tell me that isn't true.
This is true. These guys are going places, John. And maybe then I'd have been looking at one of the publishing house's other marquee titles, such as Asia-Pacific Baker or European Baker. Who knows? But by
you've
now,
cried,
John...
You've cried wolf too many times, Andy. I don't believe these exist.
It's all true. By now, I could be the Randolph Hearst of business-to-business trade magazine specialising in the starchy foods industry. But instead, I had to settle for showbiz. Amongst my other rejections, John, an offer to do a free encore at the Comedy Store in Manchester, December 2002. That was rejected pretty volubly.
Yeah, and unanimously.
Yeah. A polite request to join the England cricket team, rejected. Fully costed plan to get my school to launch a nuclear weapons programme, rejected. Apparently the last chemistry teacher tried it, ended up blowing half of Kent. And a demand for state immunity from prosecution in return for information about who killed the Queen Mother, rejected. So I'm just... all I'm saying, kids, is... learn to live with it. And now it's St. Valentine's Day Fact Box. Anonymity is a key plank of what Valentine's Day is all about. St. Valentine, after whom the day is named, took this anonymity so far that nobody knows who the f*** he was, or where the f*** he was from, or even exactly when the f*** he lived. All that's known about him is that he's almost certainly dead by now, probably the victim of a martyrdom-related crime. And that when he was alive, he loved writing rhyming couplets inside folded over bits of card and eating pink food. Also, the traditional anonymity of Valentine's Day is why the perpetrators of the Valentine's Day massacre were able to keep their identities a secret. If the massacre had happened on any other day of the year, legally, they'd have had to fess up. Also, there are many famous romances sparked into life on Valentine's Day. Sultry screen sex siren sorceress Marilyn Monroe wooed ace playwright Arthur Miller with a Valentine's Day card containing a four-act play about the Salem witchcraft trials. Prefaced with the poem, "If it was 1692, I'd put my witchy spell on you." Miller later claimed the work as his own and called it the Crucible. Queen Victoria and Prince Albert got together when he organised a 21-cannon salute to her in Morse code, spelling out the words, "Hey, Queenie, you've set my Teutonic heart a-buzzin'. Don't be put off just because I'm your first cousin." And Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, they hooked up on Valentine's Day 2002 when they were both stood up by blind dates at Jongleurs Comedy Club in Birmingham. Coincidentally, they'd both split up from their previous partners exactly 1 year before. Pitt left his then-girlfriend, the former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, after she received a card that he thought might have been from Yasser Arafat, whilst Jolie dumped her beau, the 1979 World Snooker Champion Terry Griffiths, after he insisted on practising his break-off shots rather than going out for a romantic dinner. And famously and disastrously, mythological Greek King Oedipus and his mummy got together on Valentine's Day, after she sent him a jokey Valentine's Day card as a nice maternal gesture in case he didn't get any from the girls in his school. He took it just a little bit too seriously. And some Bugle Valentine's Day tips, including how best to broach the subject, whilst guaranteeing the level of anonymity that guarantees your intended love will remain completely unaware. Well, the best way is to infiltrate your local radio station as a newsreader and deliver a bulletin in which the first letter of each word, when written out, spells out John Keats's hit platinum-selling love poem, "Bright Star, Would I Were Steadfast As Thou Art." Alternatively, get your best friend, on whom you know your Valentine has a long-standing crush, to write the card for you, obviously in their own handwriting, and sign it with their own name. That way, your would-be love will have no idea that it is actually from you. And also, never deliver a Valentine's message at gunpoint.
Back to Satirist for Hire now, and we're going to pop across the Irish Sea to the wonderful city of Dublin.
So, Tibbs Ashton, are you here? Hello. Well, you also asked about Nigel Farage and, his proposal that Ireland should rejoin the Commonwealth. who's in favour of that? The Old Buddies Club. I think sport is the closest we ever get to apologising for some of the, what might be described as, procedural glitches of our imperial age. And cricket... Sorry? Cricket is, yes. And in fact, the famously... You know, that's the closest we've ever got. Because we never fully apologised here, have we? I mean, I think the Queen used the word regrettable about some of the more excessively enthusiastic British actions. If I may, I have got my subscription to the British Euphemism Society. Regrettable. They were regrettable, which means that they... We haven't actually regretted them yet, but we know that there is the potential to regret them. That's very, that is a step forward. Baby steps. Baby steps. But the closest we ever get is letting other countries beat us at sports. Sports that we invented. Cricket, in particular. Bangalore, 2011. The Irish, the Ireland cricket team beat the England cricket team. Yeah. Led by Kevin O'Brien, who had dyed his hair pink for the occasion. So we were beaten in a cricket match, A, by Ireland, and B, by a guy with pink hair. That truly felt like the end of English civilization to me. That was the absolute lowest point. And clearly we could have won that game. We had you guys on the rack. But no, we thought of the broader picture, the conciliation between our nations, and we let you win. So that's it. And sport is about joy. That's what sport is all about, joy. It's about bringing happiness to people. And we brought happiness to Irish people that day. We brought happiness to billions of Indians, Australians, back at the end of the world. We're very good at it, really. Anyway, on a sports note, the growing suggestion that Dublin should be split into two counties for Gaelic football due to their dominance. Is this... I mean, who are you? Are you fans of Gaelic football? Yeah. And hurling? Yeah. I'll get onto this here, because the origin of sport... I'm fascinated by the origin of sports, and we'll get onto your local... Your Irish sports as well. Trampolining, that began, the CIA invented, you might know this as an American, the CIA invented trampolining in the 1960s as a torture technique. But it was a very liberated time in the 60s, and they were trying something different. They were trying for inverse torture, where you make people so relaxed and happy that they just splurt all their secrets out. But it didn't work, so they then switched to waterboarding, which conversely sounds fun. But is not. And it's an amazing number of things that sound fun but aren't. For example, Ebola! And Chairman Mao's Little Red Book, which sounds like a delightful bedtime story for a child, doesn't it? Any parents out there, do not use it as a bedtime story for a child. Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun. Sleep well, cupcakes. So that's the origin of trampolining. The origin of, hurling. This goes back a long way. Do any of you know the origin of hurling? It's quite an interesting story. Yeah, the origin...
A slightly more dangerous version of war.
It's not that, actually. It actually came after St. Patrick had chased the snakes out of Ireland. He thought, what next? He thought, I'm going to hit the hedgehogs out of Ireland as well. Patrick, we don't mind the hedgehogs. Oh, well, in that case, I'll focus on catapulting the pigeons into space. Look, it was really just the f***ing snakes, Patrick, but let me do my job. I'm going to discus the tortoises into the Atlantic. No, right. And who said comedy can't be educational? Now, Gaelic football, that goes back to the legendary Irish king, I might have pronounced this wrong, Gruaidh Foroigneach of dumb Gralux. He defeated the Vikings at the Battle of Strigagagagalan by chopping off the head of Viking leader Eric the Shit and kicking it first over and then into the open mouth of a dragon. So that's is Dublin very dominant in football? Yes. Do you think something needs to be done about it to make it more? I mean, maybe you could just try selling all the clubs to Russian oil billionaires and dodgy oil magnates from the Gulf area, because that's what sport's really about. You know, that's when you think of all those Bangladeshi slave labourers in the UAE who are going to be watching Manchester City thinking, yes, that is my team. That is my... Like all those oil workers in Siberia when Abramovich bought Chelsea thinking, at last, I have something to work for. Are you fans of football? Soccer, football? Yes? Because I like all sports, generally, but I get annoyed by players feigning injury in football. I guess that probably doesn't happen in hurling too much. Well, players have been known to be decapitated and play on, and they just like hold their head in one hand. But in football, they are learning from other sports, learning from rugby, bringing in video refs. I'm not sure that's going to work because fundamentally, players often you have a player diving and being fouled simultaneously, and it's a huge waste of money. I think rather than the video refs in football, they should just get a pagan priest to stand by the side of the pitch. And whenever there is a controversial decision, they turn to the priest, and the priest slays a goat, slices open its guts, rips it open, and looks at the entrails of this dead goat and says, yeah, that was offside. And I think we'd respect that just as much, as long as you do it with confidence and as long as there's consistency. That's what the fans want. Ryan Kenahan, are you here? Thanks for this, Ryan. Would you please satirise how everyone thinks their kid is a genius? I mean, I know my kids are geniuses, so it's not the same for me. But I have noticed, travelling around Ireland, there are quite a lot of statues of the ultimate mother who thought their kid was so special. that joke could have gone in a number of different ways. How do you like it? And look, as I said, I'm Jewish, so that joke's fine. Anyway. And you also ask, I teach architecture.
Ooh.
All right, Christopher Wren, don't f***ing flash it about, mate. Now, I could really do use a few puns. Any chance of an architectural pun run? So, well, I mean, it's always a risk doing this not as the very last thing of a gig, but I had a friend who was... I had a friend who was an architect. Look, to people who do not listen to The Bugle, this bit will now be very confusing indeed. But I had this friend who was an architect, and he won an award and had to go and collect it at a gala ceremony in the US. He said, I'm going to invite all my favourite former Democratic presidents. Jimmy, Bill, Barack. And I said, why do you think the American people voted for Trump? And he said, simple, they got thick. Got thick. Got thick. Yeah, these are going to be architectural style, so strap in. I said, I think that's an oversimplification, mate. Anyway, we started discussing which historical figures he'd hypothetically like to invite to his dream fantasy award ceremony. He said, Genghis Khan, Alaric the Visigoth, Ivan the Terrible, and Attila the Hun. Gosh, I replied, that is a brutal list. Thank you. Anyway, also, it wasn't just an architect. He set up a business selling decorative fossils and French water. He called it the Rock O Co. Anyway, well, he was. At his house, his phone went off, made his dog bark. There were lots of bow wows. Bow house. And he said, I've got to take this. I said, is it a booty call? And he said, not exactly. It's my collie dog who lives with my animal film obsessed ex wife over the pond in the Big Apple. So, no, it's not a booty call. It's a New York classy call. Does that work? Neoclassical? New York? Anyway. He spent a lot of time in America with his celebrity friends. He told me he had once gone to a party with Simon and Garfunkel and had seen the latter in deep conversation with the 1988 Olympic 100-metre champion Florence Griffith Joyner. Wow, I said. I had no idea that Art Nouveau... Art Nouveau? Anyway... Right, just two more. Right. So my friend, he was obsessed with the Old Testament. He designed an ark. It was 14 stories high, his ark. He had different decks for all the different groups of creatures to minimise the risk of predation. He explained, I put the apex predators on deck A right at the top. You've got scavengers on deck C, for example, poultry on deck H. And I said, where have you put the snakes? And he said, I hate those slithery bastards. I want them out of the way, right at the bottom. On deck N, I said, no, there's no deck I, because it looked like deck one, won't it? So they're not on deck N. I said, ah, deck O. Nailed the dismount. Anyway. But he also he had to work on a farm for a bit when business wasn't so good. So, but he had this almost supernatural intuition for when to bring in dried grass before the weather turned and it started pissing it down. He had an amazing rain hay sense. Rain hay sense. Right, that is it.
Well, that concludes this week's free bonus sub-bugle. Bugle, I do hope you've enjoyed it. Don't forget to come to all of the remaining tours on my Satirist for Hire show and send in your emails to satirisethis@satiristforhire.com. The remaining shows are the 19th of February in Canterbury. That is alarmingly soon, or already in the past, depending on when you listen to this. Then the 26th of February in Newcastle, the 27th in Chorley, and the 3rd of March in Cambridge, finishing on the 4th of March in Bristol. Also, I'm doing a charity fundraising gig on the 1st of March in Brixton in London in aid of refugees, who generally could do with a little bit of help. I will tweet details of that in the near future. And my show at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival in April is now on sale. Details on the internet. I will also be doing shows in Sydney, Auckland and Wellington. And don't forget the Radiotopia live tour of the East Coast of the USA begins on the 7th of May. Do come along to see a bugle stroke illusionist mashup featuring me and my sister Helen Zaltzman. Next week, we will have the best bits of the Bugle live show at the Leicester Square Theatre in London, featuring Nish Kumar and Alice Fraser. Until then, Buglers, goodbye.